Welcome to the Ashes to Wings podcast, where we tell stories of overcomers and give you tips and tricks to living a fuller, more embodied life. Here's your host, Jenny O'Connor.
Hey friends, welcome to Ashes to Wings. Today we'll be talking with Nathan Blair, who is the founder of the Somatic School, helping practitioners develop the skills they need to work with the body's intelligence online and in person. He is mad about the body and the embodied wisdom available to us at all times when we take time to listen. So Nathan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Jenny. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Nathan, most of our listeners have no idea what a somatic school is. Explain somatics for us.
A lot of people are familiar with that concept of mind, body, spirit. So you could say it's the idea of that unity of body and mind. I talk a lot about the body mind as one word. And that's a sort of attitude that somatic psychologists would come with. Soma is actually an ancient Greek word that means the body in its full aliveness, not just the skin and bones, but an inspirited body, and the opposite of that would be nekros, so a body without spirit. So it's not just our physical being, but what it is to be an embodied being, alive and living as a body.
So seeing ourselves as more of a whole person instead of in fragments, so to speak.
That's right, an integrated whole, exactly. Oh,
so what kind of changes have you seen somatics make in people's lives?
So I always say that science is a beautiful intersection between science and spirituality. It sort of sits right at the heart of that. We live in a world that in many ways is disconnected from self, from others, from the environment. So somatics offers, I suppose, a journey of reconnection. Like I said, that sort of intersection of the two, it also introduces a sort of connecting up of two worlds that might otherwise be siloed or separated in schools of thought as well. So there's a kind of coming together, and East meets West as well. Somatics offers a reconnecting in all ways. I haven't really answered your question exactly.
I was going to say, I like that you say that East meets West. They're not mutually exclusive, but you actually work with both together, Eastern and Western mindsets.
Absolutely, yes. So somatics in practice, the application, in a sense, is sort of the practical application of what the wisdom traditions of the East have been talking about for thousands of years. Nothing new in that sense, but it's also supported by the latest research in sciences such as embodied cognition or interpersonal neurobiology. That one's a bit of a mouthful. that are really revealing just how central our bodies are to our intelligence. So yeah, East meets West, old and new.
Can you break down interpersonal neurobiology for us?
Yeah, for sure. So interpersonal neurobiology is a fascinating emerging field of scientific research and study. It's an interdisciplinary field that actually brings together over 40 different disciplines, ranging from anthropology, sociology, biology, psychology, and the likes. And so there's so many different, what would formerly be quite separate in their own sort of studies and research, coming together and looking at where the findings, the word they use is coalesce. In other words, where does what they're discovering show patterns or meet or complement one another? And what that's giving us is a more integrated picture. And I'm using that word again, integration, which we're probably going to talk about a lot. I imagine it will come up a lot. But it's like a more integrated picture of the human being. You know, one of the fascinating things I think that it includes as well is the importance of relationship. So we are social animals, and how our relationships shape our brains, our whole way of being, our body, mind as well.
So I'd imagine this last year with everybody in quarantine and having limited social interactions, except for online like we are now, I'd imagine that that really affects social interactions and the way that we're behaving, the way that we're interacting with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. This is an extraordinary time, right? What's interesting about a global pandemic is it sort of reveals in a kind of quite an incredible and controversial but incredible metaphor for the interconnected nature of our species. A whole planet become infected by this virus. And that's passed on, you know, through interaction and through us coming into contact with one another. And then as a result, we then become distanced from one another and isolated. So it's interesting. On the one hand, it sort of revealed how interconnected we are. And at the same time, it sort of resulted in a lot of disconnection.
Fascinating. So how did you get into somatics? What led you to it?
It's interesting. As a child, I was very sensitive, often be described as sensitive. As a young child, I actually saw that as not a good thing. It didn't feel like something to aspire to. It didn't feel like something that, you know, that sensitivity felt like it was explained a little bit when I got diagnosed as having ADHD. For me, I was actually I took medication for ADHD, so Ritalin, I think it's the most commonly known, and up until my mid-20s. But around that time, I began to look for more natural treatments, you could say, for like the ADHD symptoms. And one of those natural methods was mindfulness and connecting to the environment through my senses sort of was a bit of a game changer. We can talk more about this later if it comes up, but it actually is supported a lot by our most sort of recent understandings of the way the nervous system operates. And they call it orientation, for example, in a lot of methodology. So I began to, I guess, self-regulate. The symptoms began to subside. I was empowered through natural means to manage the symptoms. Fast forward, when I discovered the field of somatics, it just spoke to what I'd intuitively felt to be interesting to me about how we are and how we could be. So somatics was like opening Pandora's box in the best way. The breadth and depth of this field is staggering, but within that is just a real goodie bag of things to explore for those who are interested in the body.
So what difference did mindfulness make in your personal health?
You know, I had a very busy mind. Who doesn't, you might say, but it was a bit like Trafalgar Square or Times Square or in my mind. Even when I was out and about, it's like there would be no hierarchy of sensory input. It just all kind of came at once, or so it seemed at the time. So one of the things I remember vividly being actually on a surf trip with some friends in Morocco and just sitting in the water, sitting on a surfboard, and I'd just been reading a book called The Mindfulness Prescription for ADHD, and it was talking all about connecting through our senses to the environment, to the here and now, the present moment. And I remember I was worried about something, and it was going around in my mind in a bit of like an obsessive loop. And I was sat out in the middle of the ocean on a surfboard. Just in that moment, I remembered, you know, what I'd been reading, and I brought my awareness very mindfully to my experience in that present moment through my senses. I felt the water kind of lapping against my fingers as I trailed it through the ocean. I listened to the bird songs, felt the breeze on my face, like watched the sun kind of going down. And it just settled me and centered me and just completely, I was just there in that moment. And I was still quite young at that point, and it was a bit of a paradigm shift for me, I think, because I didn't have to do a lot to manage, improve my situation. I actually did a lot less. The results were great. So
more being, less doing.
More being, less doing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I know you mentioned that you were called sensitive or considered sensitive as a child, and there's such a stigma against men being sensitive, which is ridiculous in my mind. But what was the hardest part about being a man who's sensitive?
That's a great question. Ironically, I think the hardest part about being a man who's sensitive is not so much how people respond to my sensitivity, but all of the ideas I had about that and how much of myself I hid as a result, or would stifle or limit or suppress. You know, and you can't numb selectively. When I withdraw, when I hold back, when I hesitate, you know, when I don't speak out, it's sort of like cutting off part of myself, and my whole self isn't showing up. So I would say that was probably the hardest part. It's just never really feeling seen, you know?
That breaks my heart a little bit. I'm glad that you feel comfortable to be your true self now, and that the society as a whole, there's so much less stigma around that now than there was even when we were younger. I think in this last year too, there's been more awareness around our need for self-care, sensitivity, mindfulness. I mean, it's a heck of a way to have to earn it, but I'm glad that there's been more focus on that in this last year.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally. I remember being in a coaching session once, actually. A neighbor of mine learned to coach. Funnily enough, it's sort of what inspired me to get into coaching in some ways. But I was receiving some coaching sessions with him, and I began to cry in one of these sessions. And I don't know what I said, but his response, he was an actor as well. And his response was like, being a man, connected with your emotions, that's actually your greatest strength. Again, like it was another sort of paradigm shift. Like, what? Great strength? I think I had to mature a bit, grow up a bit to realize how that was the case, perhaps. But the same was true for the sensitivity, particularly in somatic work. If you're somebody who's highly sensitive, you know, it's that phrase, highly sensitive people. But if you identify as someone who's sensitive, or you feel particularly sensitive, or you're somebody who picks up on facial expressions or tone of voice or a deep breath or things like that in others, particularly, you know, that deep empathy, that in somatic work is, you know, you got a good head start to being a competent practitioner in that work. That flipped it on its head. Finding this work, not only did I get to embrace the sensitivity, but actually I got to lead with that. And yeah, we live in a world that's definitely more accepting of that now. Although it's still the case that men don't really know exactly what it means to be a man right now, or how to behave post Me Too and that sort of thing. So it is still an interesting time for guys.
Definitely. I love what you said there. Something that you've been told maybe your whole life is a flaw is now your greatest superpower as a somatic coach. That's what makes you good at what you do. And I think that's such a beautiful message for people that maybe have been struggling with something that they see as a flaw, or they've been told their whole life, this is a flaw, this is something wrong with you, this is something you need to fix. That might be the key to what makes you truly great.
Yeah, totally. One thing I haven't told your listeners, I guess, is that the other side of my working life is I'm a coach. Work with somatics, work with coaching. Together, that's somatic coaching or body-oriented coaching. And so when I first began coaching, I had this little slogan that said, you're all right, as in not all right, A-L-R-I-G-H-T, but all right, like A-L-L, right. And there's something I think in that, that that's actually implicit in a lot of somatic work, which says everything that we are, everything that we do has an inherent intelligence. For example, some coaches will often ask the question, how do I work with resistance in my clients? How do I work with resistance? And it becomes oppositional. You know, it's the coach versus resistance, or coach and client versus their resistance. How do we bust through, you know? And in somatic work, something, a theme such as resistance would actually be viewed in some schools of somatics as an intelligent adaptation. At some point in that person's life, that particular behavior, that way of being, it served them. Maybe it kept them safe. Maybe it even kept them alive. You know, so how might we welcome and approach each of these emerging ways of being or whatever with the kind of respect and acknowledgement and appreciation that personally I think it deserves, but the school of somatics would kind of perceive it in that way. So yeah, you're all right. None of you is wrong, you know?
Yeah.
Broken.
Again, such an important message, especially for younger people, I think, to know that everything is there for a reason. And if we treat it as something that may be teaching us a lesson or protecting us for something instead of trying to purge it, get it out, fix it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Carl Rogers said something along the lines of, the ironic thing is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change. So I guess it's in line with that thinking as well.
So how are our bodies connected with our intelligence?
That's a big question.
You can do it. I believe in you.
Practitioner called Lisa Feldman Barrett recently wrote an article that says your brain is not thinking, quite controversially, but it describes how the brain, its sort of main function is to kind of run the balances on our energy use in the body. So that's kind of an idea of the brain being there to manage the balance, kind of homeostasis within the system. There's plenty of other ways. So like, for example, in the psychology of embodied cognition, there's lots of talk about the way that information loops within the body, the way that sometimes that we respond to situations quite often actually from an embodied place. So the body responds before we consciously are aware of what we're doing. You could look at it from the perspective as well of Deb Danner, one of the thinkers of the becoming more widely known polyvagal theory. She says the term, you know, story follows state. And so from that perspective, you could argue that everything that we do emerges out of the autonomic state that we're currently in. Are we in our safe and social, everything's cool, I'm okay, all good here space? Or are we in fight or flight or freeze? I'm using the terms that are more familiar, but the sympathetic activation, dorsal vagal, the kind of technical terms, but these will influence our thinking, our actions, our behavior. In other ways, you know, the mirror neurons or the resonance circuitry is how it's described by Daniel Siegel, who's the person who created or kind of founded interpersonal neurobiology, talks about how things like mirror neurons and other parts of the brain and the biology are kind of our basis for empathy. So things like emotional intelligence, which are, you know, known to be better predictors of business success. Things like that.
And explain just real quickly, brief overview of mirror neurons for people.
Yeah, totally. So there's a bit of controversy around mirror neurons, but nonetheless, the kind of current thinking around it is that, just in a nutshell, if we perceive an action or a behavior in another, the same areas of our brain and body actually kind of activate or light up as if we were performing that action ourselves. So it enables us when we're with others and when we're observing nonverbal communication, which makes up a huge part of our communication with one another, we are able to know, is somebody trustworthy or not? Can we make a guess at their intention, what they're doing or what they're going to do? It's how we begin to develop bonds, but it's also how we learn. You know, it's how infants learn behavior through observing and witnessing primary caregivers doing those behaviors and actions and things like that. So that's mirror neurons. Empathy, emotional intelligence. The last thing I'll talk about in terms of the body's intelligence is this phenomenon called the felt sense, which is what a lot of people would describe as intuition. So it might be that intuitive pulling in the gut or a kind of a feeling of your heart opening in any given instance. And that can kind of direct and guide us. It's based on a lifetime of experience, and it's a meaningful bodily felt experience. Really, when we can listen to that, it can become an incredible guide in our lives, and it can become an incredible source of wisdom. And in my mind, that's another source of knowing. It's another intelligence beside the intellect.
So sort of that trust your gut feeling.
Yeah, you know, that phrase, trust your gut, is totally, that's speaking directly to this notion of the felt sense, which is a term that was coined by someone called Eugene Genlin. Eugene Genlin was a philosopher and a therapist. He coined this term to describe this phenomenon that we all have, but some are more, perhaps a bit more practiced, a bit more sensitive, or a bit more connected to it than others, but we can all develop that capacity within ourselves. So in other words, you could say that we all have the potential or the ability to become more in touch with our intuition, or more intuitive, or more embodied, you know, in that sense. It's available to all of us, or most of us, taking into consideration neurodiversity and things like that.
When we spoke before, you mentioned that we've lost touch with what makes being human magical. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked me that, because this is something, I guess, that I'm passionate about. I read a gorgeous book called Original Wisdom by someone called Robert Wolf. And they were describing the Singoi tribe in Malaysia, who are far from modern civilization, technology, etc. These are one of the few remaining untouched tribal communities. The people of this community within Malay, they have a certain kind of connection with themselves, with each other, with the environment, that when we look at that, we might perceive as supernatural. You know, it's like a way of knowing when somebody's going to arrive at the village without being told that they were on their way. Or it's a way of being able to sense out in the forest where they might find a source of water. And for some people, this might be like, oh, it's a bit of a stretch. But Robert Wolf is quite an interesting person because he actually speaks fluent Malay and was able to live with this community and actually communicate and learn from them. And so actually really embedded in there. So doing some real kind of empirical study there. And while we in the Western modern kind of, you know, in our modern cultures might not be able to fully know that kind of connection with self other than the environment, I do believe that we can begin to sort of touch it or begin to get closer to it. And that I truly think is available to all of us. I'm not too keen on the phrase, but it is our birthright in the sense that we have all the gear, we have all the kit, all the equipment we need for this. And when we connect with our full sensory potential, it can feel out of this world, but it's as natural as it gets. There's something in the simplicity of it that gives us the ability to sense and feel and become aware of what we might otherwise dismiss or miss, etc. And that can be an incredible source of insight, intuition, you know, direction, knowledge, etc. So, and now that's the experience of my clients who work in this way, or our clients, people who work in this way, like yourself, and those who participate in somatic practices, deepening into that, the roots of our humanity.
I remember reading there was someone who decided to live as if they were in the 1800s for a while, you know, and no technology and everything just cut back and weeded back. And she was talking about how she almost felt like she developed extra senses because she had tuned out all of the noise, so to speak, the digital noise. And even just her long skirts, she could kind of use it like cat whiskers, you know, where she's kind of feeling where things were. And she was saying it was really interesting how when you tuned out the modern society, that you were so much more tuned into your body and tuned into what was going on in nature around you. So along those lines, talk to me about how modern society teaches us to interact with ourselves.
That's another great one. These are great questions, Jack. Personally, and this is just an opinion, as with anything I say, take what you like and leave the rest, but I personally believe, or I feel, that modern society trains us to escape ourselves more than it trains us to be with ourselves in any meaningful way. And there's nothing inherently wrong with these things, but you could argue that through mass consumerism, through a highly stimulated environment, people in Silicon Valley being paid the big bucks to literally get us addicted to our phones and software, you know, smartphones and software and things like that. It's well known these days, right? And these experiences, there's a sort of, if you buy this, you'll feel better, you know, or why sit there feeling the kind of the agony of inertia? You've been locked down for months now, you know. Why sit there feeling that when you could be on TikTok?
You're not on TikTok.
You know, like I said, there's nothing wrong with this. Like, occasionally I jump on. I think oftentimes when we've been on TikTok, for example, for like more than an hour, something in us says, I think we've crossed a certain threshold here.
You go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, exactly, right? Same on YouTube, same on Instagram. But, you know, that's an example of a disconnection from what our sensing cells knows and will tell us when we listen. You're tired. You're kind of beginning to fade out here. There's a need that needs to be met, whether that be eating, sleeping. And when we're not listening, we can bypass or kind of like bulldoze over that. And increasingly, the more we do that, we're beginning to hardwire or practice, let's say, a habit of impulse arises from the body and lack of response. And through somatic work, we're beginning to develop a meaningful way of being with ourselves. One example of that might be impulse, hunger, responding and resonance, feed myself. Impulse, fatigue, rest. And we don't live in a culture that supports that much.
Yeah.
Either impulse, my back hurts. I'd actually be more comfortable lying on the floor. I'm in a business meeting. It's inappropriate, right?
Yes.
So,
and that's something that I truly love about somatics in general and your school in specific is you respect the authority of the body. And so this is something that I've adopted in my classes, in my coaching. If you need to get up and move around, get up and move around. If you need to go get a drink of water, listen to your body and follow through, because we're taught to kind of tune that out and neglect that. And no, I've got an 8-hour conference and no, I can't possibly leave to go to the bathroom. You know, that's not normal. So a small good that's come out of this last year is society is more accepting of humanity. Your kid just ran in the room and sitting there in pajama pants and a top. I feel like there's been so much more welcoming of your human being, and you don't have to be on all the time.
Yeah. Don't have to be on all the time. Yeah. That's so, that feels so appropriate in so many layers, because on all the time in one sense is like wearing the mask, you know, the facade, or like, you know, suiting up and showing up. But also our nervous systems in an overstimulated environment are just stuck on. We're just overworked, underrested. And that's not anyone's fault necessarily. It's just a systemic thing. You know, I'm obsessed with Taoism. Absolutely obsessed. It's problematic.
I mean, it's a good addiction to have.
Yeah, I agree. There's a lovely concept called Wu Wei. It sort of translates to not doing or doing nothing, or it's the whole idea of, you know, also effortless action. But, you know, there's something there that we're becoming more accepting of each other's humanity. And then part of that is that our needs for rest, and when we reach that threshold, is a lot lower than a lot of us might believe when we're in this kind of production-based, post-industrial kind of world that's all about creating, making, achieving. There's a new kind of narrative, I think, emerging, which is like sleep <You know? laughs> and take care of yourself, listen to your body and slow down. Then that's just lovely to see, because actually the irony a lot of the time is that we can actually accomplish a lot. There's this passage from the Tao Te Ching written by Lao Tzu that says, nature does not hurry, yet everything is accomplished. It's this kind of idea of going with the natural flow, our cycles, the rhythms, and can we kind of tune into that? It's a bit of a complicated thing, because it's a little bit to our, in modern Western world, the idea of doing nothing doesn't make any sense, but it doesn't mean nothing at all. It's a little bit different to that. But it's very aligned with somatic work, which has this trust in this organic, intelligent unfolding of things.
Absolutely. That's basically the premise of my Lunai class. We use the moon cycles to kind of cycle through your different energy levels. And it's taking time to work hard and to plan and to have that yang energy and that masculine, you know, forward moving. And then to take time to rest and release and sort of that yin energy where we're just going with the flow. And it's following that cycle because you need the rest time to be productive. If you're constantly in that aggressive energy, you burn out. And as somebody who's an overachiever trying to do all the things, I have to schedule my rest time or I will just go.
totally. Yeah, guilt, me too.
Yes.
I'm totally, you know, card carrying member of that club. And there's this understanding of this human as an integrated system. There's this concept of it's called the default mode network in the brain. And research shows that it's where we kind of do our most creative, innovative thinking and problem solving, you know, which are qualities that NASA and Google, places like that, really want in spades. You know, they want that sort of thing in their employees in abundance, right? It tends to come online in the rest period.
Yes, I was just reading a book on this. You know, they're talking about how that's why right before you fall asleep or when you're in the shower not doing anything, that's when you get your most creative ideas because your brain is kind of taking a break.
Yeah, totally right. Yeah, well, that's what the research suggests anyway.
Yeah. Well, Nathan, our podcast is called Ashes to Wings, referring to the story of the phoenix transforming and rising from the ashes. I like to ask all of our guests this question. What does rise above mean in your life?
Weirdly enough, bit of a, like a backwards answer to this, but it's like rise above in my life, just allow everything to be just as it is. And for me, that's how I kind of come out of the suffering or chaos or whatever, you know.
So I'm almost picturing you in the jet stream, you know, over where most airplanes fly, and you get into that jet stream and you just flow so much faster because you're kind of above where you're having to put in all that effort and just kind of flow state.
Yeah. Nice.
Love that. So Nathan, I always like to leave our Ashes to Wings listeners with a bumper sticker statement, a summary of what you've just talked about that would fit on a bumper sticker. So what would your bumper sticker be?
I would say, and I said it a little earlier, but I'll say it again, discovering our sensory potential feels out of this world when it's been so long since we've been connected in this way, but it's as natural as it gets.
Good. And then I have a few rapid fire fun questions for you, if you're game for it. If you had to delete all but 3 apps from your cell phone, which ones would you keep?
Sadly, my emails, but it's true. If I hadn't just got a new phone-free meditation alarm clock thing, it's super cool, I would keep Insight Timer. And a third one, it's going to be WhatsApp. But that's just because during this time, it's really kept particularly my family, especially with my sister living across the other side of the world in Australia, connected. And that's quite a miraculous thing. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Nice. What is your superpower?
Sensitivity.
A bit like a cape and sensitivity man. What are your favorite pizza toppings?
You know, it doesn't matter what happens. I sometimes get creative, but if somebody's ordered just pepperoni and mozzarella base, I get jealous. So I'm going to say just a normal pepperoni pizza. Otherwise, I get hardcore.
Nice. So not Hawaiian. Do you guys have Hawaiian pizzas in Britain?
Yeah, let's get serious.
There's 2 camps. I feel like there's the it's good and the it's an abomination. Yeah.
Totally.
Yes. What is your guilty pleasure song?
Oh, it's so easy. Taylor Swift, any of them. I'm such a Swiftie. Yes. It's my guilty pleasure. Hardcore.
I mean, how can you not?
That's out of the bag.
Yes. what is left on your bucket list?
Wow. So I'm going to give you the cheesy one first.
Yes. Okay.
Grandma, she was an artist, you know, like she was a professional, she'd be an artist. And one of the things on my bucket list is to exhibit her artwork before it's too late. So we want to, she's getting on, so we'll be doing that soon. The less cheesy one is I want to be snowboarding every winter, scuba diving every summer.
That sounds amazing. I live in Chicago, but I hate the cold, so I have not been snowboarding, but I haven't been scuba diving either, but I want to.
Well, do it.
Sometime in the near future, when we can travel again. What book belongs on everyone's bookshelf? I picked this one specifically for you because I know you're a book nerd like me.
Oh, how do I choose? I mentioned The Original Wisdom earlier. I'm going to go with that one. I'm going to go with that one. All the Tao Te Ching. I snuck that in there. But the Tao Te Ching, a little bit, for some people, it might not completely resonate. Original Wisdom is just gorgeous.
Love that. And who wrote Original Wisdom?
Robert Wolff.
Okay.
Wolff. Yes. I'm looking over here.
It's your bookshelf.
I keep looking over to my right because that's where my bookshelf is.
I have like a list of titles recommended by Nathan that I need to start working my way through. Well, Nathan, I know you mentioned you have a special offer for our Ashes to Wings listeners.
Yeah, well, two things. So the first is we got a free introduction to body-oriented coaching. It's online. It's at a good time for most time zones. So that they happen regularly. And I think, Jenny, you've got the link for that. So I think you'll be sharing that. You know, that's an introduction to, so the event's entirely free to attend. And the whole event covers what is body-oriented coaching and the field of somatics, broadly speaking, where it came from, why it matters, and what it might look like to work with that in practice. One of the ways that you might do that is a training that we run at the Somatic School, which is called the Accredited Certificate in Body-Oriented Coaching. Now, if you were to enroll in that course, there's another offer for Ashes to Wings listeners, which is we'll include in that course a bonus Organic Intelligence for Coaches course, which if you haven't heard of Organic Intelligence, check it out. It's pretty cool. And then an ICF mentoring program, which is anyone who wants to actually become a ICF credentialed coach, which is some further credibility, you can go on and get those ICF mentoring hours. And so we're going to bundle that in either one of those two for your listeners, Jenny.
Thank you so much. And you guys can find that deal along with Nathan's social media links on his guest page on our website. So that's ashes2wings.net/Nathan-Blair, B-L-A-I-R. And thank you for those, Nathan. That's amazing. And do they need to be coaches to enroll in these things?
I'm glad you asked because I mentioned coaching a few times there. And the answer is no. Typically, most people who enroll in training have some existing practice or career that has a relational dimension to it. That includes quite a few careers. It's all you really need is a desire to work with people one-to-one typically or in groups and work at somatic depth or work with the body's intelligence in that context.
Perfect. Well, Nathan, thank you so much for joining us today. This was amazing.
Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure and it's an honor. Thank you so much for asking me to come.
Absolutely. I'd like to introduce a new feature that we'll be doing in some of our episodes, and that is the review shout out. If you leave us a review and a rating, you might just get your review read on the air. So our first one is from Broninator and reads, "Real and super good tips. Jenny is real and I'm loving her personality. The short tip episodes are super useful and really fun too." Thanks so much, Broninator. Make sure you leave us a rating and review and you might hear yours read on the air. So just a quick recap of our episode with Nathan Blair today. We talked about somatics and how science is revealing just how central our bodies are to our intelligence and supporting what the wisdom traditions of the East have been teaching for thousands of years. We talked about how we've lost touch with what makes being human magical. And we talked about how modern society teaches us to escape ourselves more than it teaches us how to be with ourselves in a meaningful way, which is just such a powerful statement. These all tie into our values at Ashes to Wings, where we're all about connecting the body, mind, and emotions. And I love the idea that what you've been told is strange is probably your greatest superpower. Don't forget to check out Nathan's guest page. Again, that's ashestowings.net/Nathan-Blair. Friends, thank you for listening. Don't forget to follow the show, rate and review, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. The best way to learn is to teach someone else. So take one thing you learned today and share it with a friend. Find Jenny on Instagram at @the_Jenny_O'Connor and online at jennyoconnor.com. Subscribe for new episodes. Until next time, rise above.